Chapter: Word of Mouth as Product Strategy. The pattern I kept tracing across this conversation is one the AEC industry hasn't yet named. The designer who applies product thinking without ever reaching for the vocabulary. Nushin Radnia, manager of design technology at Hart Howerton, runs a technology function within a firm whose business model is qualitative, whose projects are irreducibly bespoke, and whose senior designers still work in trace paper. She has built a more coherent product model than many people who hold the job title. What follows is a conversation about what product thinking actually looks like when the product is a human experience rather than a feature set, and when the market is a 60-year design legacy rather than an addressable segment. About Nushin Radnia. Nushin Radnia is manager of design technology at Hart Howerton, a certified B Corp interdisciplinary design firm specializing in luxury hospitality, resort, and master planning across 30-plus countries. Originally trained as an architect in Iran, she holds dual master's degrees in architecture and information technology from UNC Charlotte, as well as a master's in interior and environmental design from Texas Tech. A creative technologist working at the intersection of architecture, computational design, and emerging media, her independent practice spans cross-disciplinary collaborations with architects, artists, and musicians across exhibitions, installations, and museum contexts. Her firm role is where those hypotheses get applied at scale.
The most profound human experiences are biological. The way we blush, the way we get goosebumps, the sudden calmness of being able to breathe deeply. However far we push the technology, that remains the measure. It's what we're designing toward, not away from.
Chapter: When Design Thinking is Product Thinking, Unnamed. There is a particular tension that arises when designers move into technology roles. They import the intellectual tools of design, empathy, iteration, prototyping, but rarely bring the vocabulary of product management along. The result is practitioners who do the work without claiming the frame. Nushin is precise about the distinction. When asked whether her role at Hart Howerton amounts to a product mission statement, her answer is careful.
Sometimes I think architecture, especially the design technology world, is very related to product management. The thinking, the approach, even the syllabus. And sometimes I'm like, no. Because that quick feedback loop doesn't translate in the same way. And especially in my role, inside a firm where every project is its own brief and its own environment, the expectation is fundamentally different. You are not rolling out one product for everyone.
The no is revealing. It isn't a rejection of product thinking. It's a rejection of the assumption that product thinking means scalable, standardized, and metric-driven. At Hart Howerton, which has built a 60-year legacy in hospitality and resort design in some of the world's most place-specific environments, efficiency is not the top metric. The firm measures success by the richness and qualitative satisfaction of the designed environment. A day in the life of a place rather than a delivery schedule. This framing has a direct consequence for how Nushin thinks about technology. Every tool she introduces must fit into a design process that is intentionally non-repeatable. A workflow built for six designers on a single beach resort project may have no equivalent elsewhere in the firm. The point is not generalization, it is bespoke fit. This is where her role diverges most sharply from the conventional product manager's mandate, and where the industry's vocabulary begins to fail her. The gap between naming and doing product thinking in AEC is not unique to Nushin. As I explored in an earlier piece on PM in AEC practice, the product manager role in AEC enterprises often suffers from an identity problem. In a pure software company, everybody gets that. In an AEC enterprise, nobody is quite sure what it is. Nushin represents the inverse of that problem. Someone who is quite sure what it is and does it fluently, but has no particular interest in the label. Chapter: The Bespoke Ceiling, Why Scaling is the Wrong Instinct. The most contested question in AEC design technology is whether bespoke workflows should be scaled. The instinct is yes. If a tool works on one project, make it work on all of them. The reality, as the scalability illusion in computational design makes clear, is that the attempt to scale a workflow into a platform often destroys what made it valuable. Nushin has arrived at the same conclusion through practice.
Every workflow is so bespoke, you're learning in this firm. 60 years of working in the same domain doesn't mean 60 years of the same solution. The typology is consistent, the place never is.
This is not a complaint, it is a design constraint. The firm's value proposition is that no two projects are alike, even within the same typology. A beach resort in Panama and a ski resort in Montana share a category, but not a set of design priorities. View corridors dominate one, wind direction governs the other. Nushin tested the limits of parametric optimization for massing early in her tenure and found that the variables shifted not just project by project, but conversation by conversation.
You are missing that actual human in the loop and the way they can prioritize it. And that can vary person by person based on the latest article you have read or the magazine you have flipped through or the conversation you had with the client.
Optimization assumes a stable hierarchy of criteria. Experiential design assumes the hierarchy is negotiated fresh each time. These two assumptions are incompatible, and no amount of parametric tooling resolves the contradiction. The human in the loop is not a limitation to be engineered around. It is the mechanism that makes the product worth having. There is a deeper argument beneath the operational one. If a firm selling the irreducibility of place succeeded in fully standardizing its process, it would produce the same optimized solution every time. That is precisely what a client paying for a resort, shaped by its specific light, wind, and material context, is not paying for. The homogenization that results from successful standardization is not a side effect to be managed, it is the destruction of the product itself. Bespoke is not a constraint the firm tolerates. It is the value the firm sells. She is moving toward a central platform not as a means of standardizing bespoke work, but as an aggregator that makes bespoke work accessible, a distribution point for scattered plugins and connectors, and a mechanism for harvesting insights from how tools are actually used. The platform doesn't replace the bespoke, it holds it. Chapter: Word of mouth as the only adoption mechanism that works. Ask Nushin how tools spread through Hart Howerton, and she doesn't describe a training program or a top-down mandate. She describes a single mechanism, a successful project.
The most successful factor, if you have it there, even if it is a semi-working tool, it's going to take. The tools and workflows that have spread through our office have all been pollinated by word of mouth. Once one project uses it successfully, it doesn't matter how difficult the integration is, you will just start hearing it. That team used it, and now this team wants it too.
She calls this the golden key. Monthly workshops and training sessions run regularly, but they are maintenance, not drivers of adoption. Adoption happens when a tool succeeds in the field, and designers tell each other. This pattern is structurally consistent with what the broader AEC industry keeps rediscovering. Top-down mandates for tool adoption routinely fail because the problem they're solving isn't a knowledge gap, it's a trust gap. Industry data confirms this. A 2026 survey of more than 2,000 AEC professionals found that the biggest barrier to adopting new technology is not cost, which ranked fourth, but time. Specifically, implementation and training taking too long. The second biggest barrier is the absence of a leadership mandate, and that finding, read carefully, reveals the mechanism. Where mandates exist without social proof, they address availability rather than trust. Architects and designers don't adopt tools because they're available or because someone ran a training session. They adopt tools because someone they respect used one on a real project and the project was better for it. Nushin's practical model for building that trust follows a recognizable product cadence, even if she doesn't frame it that way. Rapid prototyping of a point solution for an identified problem. A trusted group of users willing to test it. Organic spread once results are visible, then deliberate scaling when the next wave arrives. The sequence is not accidental. It is the same logic that underlies early adopter programs in product development. The pathway from pilot to adoption runs through social proof, not documentation. What makes this model coherent in her context is that Hart Howerton's project structure provides a natural unit of validation. Each project is a contained experiment with clear outputs. Client satisfaction. the richness of deliverables, and whether the design team met all the criteria they needed to. A tool that helps a project team do that better becomes the recommendation for the next project. The firm's bespoke culture, which might seem hostile to technology adoption, is the very structure that enables word-of-mouth propagation. Chapter: The Analog-Digital Coexistence, Advantage Not Friction. One of the most counterintuitive observations Nushin offers is that Hart Howerton's senior designers still work in trace paper and hand sketching, and she considers this an asset. The conventional interpretation of a mixed method firm is that it is transitioning, senior practitioners holding on to old workflows, junior designers pulling the firm forward. Nushin reframes this as a permanent and productive asymmetry.
The analog part, the physical tangible part, has never been lost. And maybe there was a point that people were critiquing that workflow, but I'm glad we maintained it.
The practical mechanism she describes involves a designer named Owen and a principal named Michelle. Owen is using AI-integrated rendering workflows. Michelle is still directing vision from a designer's instinct. Owen describes himself as Michelle's AI. The principal's intelligence runs through his tools. What the firm produces is not the output of either working in isolation, but the translation layer between them. That translation layer carries an unexpected feedback loop. One senior principal who began using AI tools that mimicked his hand-drawn marks discovered that precision mattered more, not less. The system was faithful enough that imprecision was amplified rather than corrected. The technology didn't just serve his instinct, it sharpened it. The tool becomes a mirror before it becomes an amplifier. This matters because it reframes the conversation about AI adoption. The question isn't whether principals will adopt AI tools. It's whether the firm can build a structure where their design intelligence is applied through people and tools who do. BIM 2.0, meaning web-based, file format agnostic access to models, is making this interoperability real without requiring everyone to change how they work. The principals or project managers who won't open Revit can still review a design by accessing the model through a web interface. A project lead on a remote hospitality site can walk through the live model on an iPad without needing a workstation or a specific file format. The criterion that unifies these solutions is the same one Nushin applies to every tool she evaluates. Does the technology fade? A tool that forces designers to think about the tool displaces design thinking. The ones that succeed are the ones that disappear into the workflow. The friction disappears not because everyone converts, but because the system becomes permeable. This also has implications for what bespoke computational design tools can and cannot do. A workflow that is genuinely bespoke, built to match a team's specific intelligence on a specific project, cannot be fully transferred to another context. What can travel is the structure that makes bespoke work legible, the central platform as aggregator, the translation layers between working modes, the review mechanisms that let design intelligence supervise without needing to operate every tool. Chapter: Measuring Success Without Efficiency Metrics. When Nushin describes how she knows a technology implementation has worked, she does not start with time saved. She starts with something more observational.
It is this ambition and curiosity that you're starting to see from the design team. The satisfaction of, it enabled me a new way of thinking or trying things I never thought I could try before.
The metrics she cites are qualitative. Higher quality results delivered within the same time period. A broader range of deliverable types covered without sacrificing any. Client satisfaction, and the number of media through which the firm can communicate the design. None of these is an efficiency metric. They are expansion metrics, evidence that the team's capability has grown, not that the same work now takes less time. This is a meaningful distinction. Efficiency metrics measure how much of the existing workflow can be automated. Expansion metrics measure whether the workflow itself has changed, whether designers are now attempting things they previously considered impossible or outside scope. The technology is succeeding not when it speeds up what was already being done, but when it changes what gets considered. The distinction also explains why Nushin is selective about which AI tools qualify. General AI image generation produces what she describes as believable but random results. Aesthetically plausible images whose geometry doesn't correspond to an actual massing model, whose site scale is invented, and whose materials bear no relation to the specific location. For a firm working across 30 countries where the sight lines, wind patterns, and local material palette are the design, a convincing image that gets the architecture wrong is not an expansion of capability. It is a substitution of fiction for precision. The tools that pass her test are those that work from geometry outward, not from text inward. Her example of AI rendering is instructive here. The historic method involved a gradual, controlled buildup of every material, texture, and light source. The designer maintained precision by accumulating detail layer by layer. AI rendering collapses that sequence. Because believable results arrive fast, designers begin thinking, in the concept phase rather than in execution, about details they previously deferred to later.
You're getting this direction of how that gutter needs to be built in this concept phase, because it showed up in that image. Those were not common objects to consider.
The hierarchy of design attention has changed. Decisions that previously existed in the execution domain are now being made during conception. AI rendering hasn't just made rendering faster, it has pulled detail-level thinking earlier in the process. Whether firms are equipped to act on that shift, or simply absorb faster rendering into an unchanged workflow, is where the real adoption question lies. Chapter: The Knowledge That Resists Capture. The conversation closes on the problem Nooshin finds hardest: whether the design intelligence accumulated in a firm over 60 years can be preserved, transferred, or distilled. Translating a design process into words or diagrams is already difficult. Translating the poetic quality of a place, the way light moves through a space, the sequence of sensory experiences that constitutes an environment, may be something else entirely.
There is a poetic quality that is not necessarily experimental. You have to experience it to understand it. From sunset to what it is casting shadow on, to what is blowing against your face, it is a series of things creating that environment. I hope you don't lose that.
Technology, she argues, has democratized certain design skills by forcing their translation into communicable form: language, multimedia, and process diagrams. If you cannot articulate your design logic, AI tools cannot reflect it back at you. The pressure to make thinking legible has a democratizing effect. Skills that were previously tacit and unteachable become partially transferable. One mechanism that addresses the processual dimension, if not the poetic one, is what she calls the digital trace. The accumulated record of how a design moved from a first sketch through every iteration to a final render. The trace doesn't capture the experience of light at a specific hour, or the sequence of sensory impressions that constitutes a place. But it does make the trajectory of decisions legible. A different kind of institutional memory, less concerned with preserving the answer than with preserving the reasoning that produced it. What neither mechanism resolves is the deeper limit. The more the design intelligence approaches the experiential, non-linear, and irreducibly subjective, the more the translation fails. The manual can be replicated, the poetic sensibility is another matter entirely. This sits at the edge of what any product system can hold. Joseph Tainter's observation in The Collapse of Complex Societies, that increased complexity carries increased costs per capita, offers a structural warning here. The attempt to build systems that capture and transfer the full richness of design intelligence may cost more to maintain than the intelligence is worth to extract. The firm's 60 years of design DNA may be best preserved not by documentation, but by the conditions that allow the next generation of designers to develop it afresh, carrying it forward in directions the original practitioners could not have anticipated. The sensibility cannot be codified, it can only be cultivated. That is a different kind of technology problem entirely. Chapter: The Method That Precedes the Name. What this conversation surfaces is not a new kind of product manager or a new model for design technology. It is something older, a practitioner who has learned, through the specific conditions of her environment, that the mechanisms of good product work, understanding users before building for them, measuring outcomes rather than outputs, letting adoption spread through trust rather than mandate, operate independently of the vocabulary used to describe them. The instinct is to solve this by importing product management as a discipline. Job titles, frameworks, OKRs, discovery cadences. That impulse is understandable. The risk is that the import is mistaken for the thing itself. What Nushin's practice suggests is that the thing itself operates in firms with the right conditions. Close collaboration between technologists and designers, a North Star grounded in human experience, and enough respect for the bespoke to resist the pressure to standardize everything. The through line is not a methodology, but an awareness. The human experience as a reference point at every level, from which to test first, to how adoption spreads through a project team, to what counts as success when a design is done. The vocabulary, when it arrives, will be useful. But the practice doesn't wait for it.